On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The scandal and division rocking China and its tip-top Communist Party leadership right now is hard to fully appreciate or understand from outside China. A charismatic party leader who's revived Maoism and fought corruption in big trouble. His wife, under investigation for murder, deep divisions in the country's leadership exposed. The biggest political crisis, we're told, since Tiananmen. This hour on point, turmoil at the top in China and the story of Bo Xilai. You can join the conversation. What is going on in China? Is this the backlash against hyper-wealth accumulation and corruption? Is this a tawdry blip or a real national stumble, a crack? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's the sound of an editorial in the Chinese communist paper People's Daily addressing the ouster of Bo Xilai from very high in the Communist Party, translated here and read by BBC Radio.
The sanctity and authority of the law shall not be trampled on. Whoever has broken the law will be handled in accordance with the law and will not be tolerated, no matter who is involved and no matter what position he is in.
It all sounds very formal and upright, but underneath there is a huge mess here with poisoning and murder and corruption charges and a real kind of right-left fight within the Communist Party leadership, we're told. Joining me first today from Beijing is Evan Osnos, Beijing correspondent for The New Yorker. He's been writing tremendously about this. Evan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
I think it's hard for Americans to, first of all, just know the facts, but then to understand what's going on here. You say the party is reeling. You and many others say this is the biggest blow-up in the leadership since the purges after Tiananmen. What's going on?
Well, this has been a story that has really exploded in a way I think that people would not have predicted. It began most dramatically about a month ago when the leader of this very large city in western China, Chongqing, a guy named Bo Xilai, who was a very dynamic up-and-coming politician, found himself suddenly in the crosshairs of the party's full investigative powers. And what happened was that, in a sense, his track record, what he had done over the last few years in becoming this very populist, very popular politician, had also alienated people within the party. And so when the opportunity came, as we'll talk about today, to go after him and to take him down, there were a lot of people who were ready and willing to do that. And one point to make is that the result has been, as you said, this crisis at the top of the Communist Party, this struggle over who will control the party, who will control the future of the country. And it's the first case like this of this kind since Tiananmen. However, the important thing to remember if you're thinking about this from far away is that it looks very, very different from Tiananmen. I mean, in Beijing today, it's quiet, and it has been quiet. I mean, Tiananmen, after all, was a period in which you had thousands of people on the street. You had student demonstrators occupying Tiananmen Square. So when people make the comparison, it has nothing to do actually with what it looks like or feels like or what it presents to the kind of day-to-day security. It has to do with the level of ideological and personal tension at the highest levels.
Entirely. As you write, Evan Osnos, it's sort of like the drama of Tiananmen, but it's all happening in a black box. I want to look at the details of this. I mean, there's just some incredible details of what's going on here. But as our listeners absorb those, and we'll go to those, but give us the framework here, because I think even the ideological struggle that is apparently underway is widely unknown to most Americans. There's talk of a new left and this sort of Kennedy-esque figure in Bo Xilai and real conflict between those who still have sympathy for the Maoist era, which put some state constraint on private wealth and corruption versus the sort of freewheeling, let's go, anything goes. I'm not sure that's how they describe themselves, but you tell us, what's the political frame and tension we should understand around these details, Evan?
To understand this case, exactly, you have to understand what Bo Xilai represents in the Chinese mind these days. You know, he is the son of a very powerful political family in China. His father is what's known as one of the eight immortals, one of the founding, essentially the founding fathers of the country. And so his son grew
that
up.
That is the Communist Party, founders of the communist regime era in China.
The People's exactly.
Yes.
When we say the country these days, mm-hmm. what we mean is the People's Republic of China, mm-hmm. which was founded in 1949. So his, you know, in the Chinese mind, he is, I mean, the comparison is sometimes made. They say, imagine if it was Robert Kennedy combined with Richard Daley. I mean, it's that kind of political pedigree.
And a little bit of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson in there as well.
Exactly. And so he grows up in this environment of enormous politicization, but also privilege. He came of age during the Cultural Revolution, which means that he was of the generation that was intimately involved in these struggles over, I mean, physical struggles in many cases. You know, there was essentially open battles in the street between these young political activists, of which he was one. He outgrew that. He eventually went into party politics and became this an up-and-coming star. He was the mayor of a city in the Northeast called Dalian. He mm-hmm. then went on to become the commerce minister. He's a backflapper. He's a sort of glad hander. He's somebody that looks very out of sorts in Chinese politics. He's an unusual figure. He looks much more like an American politician. And after he got to Chongqing, he became something else as well, which was that he started to distinguish himself. He started to try to sort of publicly lobby for his own political future by becoming redder than red. I mean, he became sort of more communist than anybody else.
And what does that mean these days in China, Evan? What is it that he's fighting for with this charismatic persona that's got the central power so upset?
What it means is that he would say that the power of the state, that the full party, the full power of the party should be restored to its height, and that it should be allowed to rein in the abuses of capitalists who have run amok. I mean, this is the way he would have described it, mm-hmm. that the party should be allowed to go back to its origins and to return a sense of social justice to the people, to close the gap between rich and poor, to bring about to purify the country morally, to get rid of corruption. All of these ideas, which actually, of course, resonate with people, but they're combined with this, it's a contradiction, because on the one hand, he's saying that the party should be the organization that brings about the cleaning of the Chinese corruption problem. It's the thing that should bring people back to a state of it should close the gap between the very, very wealthy and the very, very poor.
Which is a huge gap in China. And ironically, what he's saying here is China needs Maoism or some element of it again. I mean, he's had his people
exactly.
in Chongqing actually singing old Maoist songs. He was SMS texting out Mao sayings to the huge megacity people of Chongqing, really looking to bring some strong elements of Maoism back to a culture that's gone very capitalist, corrupt, whatever you want to call it.
Exactly. I mean, and that actually endeared him to people. I mean, there was a group of people, and you're seeing it this week now that he's fallen. You hear voices. I had a conversation today with a cab driver who was saying, you know, Bo Xilai, say what you will about him, but he looked out for the common man. But the interesting thing, of course, is that, you know, so he's on one side of this ideological mm-hmm. divide. And on the other side, as you said, is this other group, the group that is calling for pro-market reforms. They're saying, look, the way that China has been able to get rid of poverty over the last 30 years is by embracing the market, by reducing the role of the party in the economy, mm-hmm. by allowing people a greater degree of freedom in their lives. That's the other view, and it's a view that's come on very strongly from southern China with a couple of political figures who are closely identified with it. And so, of course, you know, what we all know is that the reason why China has been able to improve the quality of people's lives over the last 30 years is by allowing the market in. But then the fact is that it's come in a spirit of sort of Wild West capitalism, and it's become here a state of such uncertainty these days. People feel like they have so little protection in their lives that Bo Xilai was able to tap into the sort of nostalgic roots that there is in Chinese political culture.
And he wasn't alone in that. You and others right. I mean, it wasn't just your cab driver who's sympathetic. There's some powerful people who think he's right. And the next thing you know, but there's many who are opposed to him, the next thing you know, we've got murder charges for the death of a Britisher associated with his family. His wife is all tangled up in that. His own police chief in Chongqing seeking refuge in the American consulate there and apparently spilling all kinds of inside information about tip-top level power struggles here. And him banished from the Politburo when he was had been presumed to be headed for the very innermost sanctum of that in this next power shift coming up, Evan.
So that's right. You had this. So the power struggle that was percolating, that was the background. And then over the last several weeks, it burst out into the open. And the way that it burst out in the open was that his longtime aide, the police chief in the city of Chongqing, suddenly, and this is an amazing thing to do, went to the U.S. consulate in a nearby city, the city of Chengdu, and asked for political asylum. And he asked for political asylum because he thought that his life was in danger. And the reason he thought his life was in danger, he has told Western officials, is that he had confronted Bo Xilai over an investigation that had suggested that Bo's wife had killed a British businessman named Neil Haywood, who had been very close to the family.
Evan, hold it right there. We have to take a short break. It's an amazing story. It goes right to the top in China, to the stability of this country. Evan Osnos is a New Yorker correspondent based in Beijing. The East is red behind us here. Old Maoist anthem that was brought back by Bo Xilai. Now he's in trouble, and there are real questions at the heart of Chinese authority. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about uproar in the very top ranks of the Chinese Communist Party. The amazing case of the now disgraced party boss Bo Xilai now threatening to undo a kind of ruling consensus in China, maybe undo elements of the party. Evan Osnos joins us from Beijing in China. He's a writer there for The New Yorker, based in Beijing. He's been writing really compellingly about this. We'll hear in a moment from Dali Yang in Beijing. You can join the conversation. Are you following this incredible story, power struggle in China, of Bo Xilai, his powerful wife, his police chief in the U.S. consulate, the dead British ally? And could this crack the leadership of the Chinese juggernaut? Is this the core inside tension in China bursting to the surface here, the old Maoist impulse rebelling at vast new wealth and inequality and corruption? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. It's bringing a lot of ancient history back to mind. Here's back in 1949, the leader of China's communist revolution, Mao Zedong himself, addressing the masses in Beijing, declaring that China a people's republic. 人民政府官，宣扬人民政府。今天，站立了。Now, Bo Xilai, the charismatic politician who was headed for the innermost sanctum of Communist Party power, in big trouble. He's not a traditional Maoist, but he's got a lot of the concern from that era that he's been riding in his public relations. Here's British MP, former British Trade Commissioner to China, Richard Graham, talking to the BBC yesterday about Bo Xilai.
To describe him purely as a throwback to the days of Cultural Revolution would be underestimating his width of appeal and indeed his own style. But he did combine an appeal through his father, in a sense, to an earlier generation, and, if you like, some sentimentality about the days of Mao Zedong, with a very modern, reformist, pro-economic development, engage with the West approach.
And here's another angle to consider. Here's Colorado lawyer Ed Byrne. He worked with Bo Xilai's wife, Gu Kailai, several years ago, and he talked with the BBC yesterday about the couple, what they meant in China.
The people likened her to her and her husband were as the Jack and Jackie Kennedy of China. They were the modern liberal element there.
Wow. So you've got a little bit of the piece of the picture here. We'll go just in just a moment to Dolly Young. But Evan Osnos, complete this circle for us. Where do all these charges stand at this point? I mean, there's a murder charge now. There's a lot of talk about corruption that may touch Bo Xilai's family. Are these for real? Or have these been brought up to sort of get them out of the way? And what are the implications for the central power of the Communist Party?
Well, as you say, one of the hard things about assessing the reliability of this case and the credibility of the evidence is that we are dependent ultimately on the information that the government is willing to put out when it comes to assessing the real evidence that it has in this case. There's been some terrific reporting by other foreign journalists who have demonstrated that, in fact, there was a relationship between Bo Xilai's family and this British businessman named Neil Haywood, who died very suddenly in a hotel room in Chongqing last November. His body was cremated. His family was told it was excessive alcohol consumption, when in fact it turns out that he barely drinks. So there's a lot of suspicious things out there. But what we don't know, and what will be very important, is to make sure that Bo Xilai and his family are treated to the same level of legal protections that anybody should be under the Chinese Constitution. At the moment, he is under detention for suspected disciplinary violations. That can mean a whole range of things, but it probably has to do with corruption or something of that kind. And his wife is actually in a different kind of detention. She and a household servant are being held on criminal suspicion of homicide. So they are out of view. They have been for weeks, and we don't yet know where this goes. But in answer to your question, what does this mean for the party? That is the big question. At the moment, we don't know what the next shoe will drop. But this is, you know, I think it's, you don't want to overstate it, and we don't want to say that this means that the party is in peril. It's not. Things are stable at the moment here. But what it does mean is that there is an intense and very personal struggle at the top, and we don't know where it's going to go.
The Communist Party reeling, Evan Osnos writes, and a rift within that party, ideological, now very much wide open. Bo Xilai in trouble, his wife in trouble, his police chief up against treason charges after he went to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu. This could go wider. His son, a student at Harvard. Also with us right now from Beijing is Dolly Young. He's faculty director for the University of Chicago Center in Beijing. Also directs the University of Chicago's Confucius Institute. He's author of Remaking the Chinese Leviathan, Market Transition and the Politics of Governance in China. Dolly Young, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're most welcome.
You have said that what we've got going on here is a very significant development, that political power is being reshaped in China around this. What's going on?
I think one of the most interesting aspects is the fact that, as Evan has emphasized, Bo represented a specific portion of the political spectrum, and with his fall, and that portion of the political spectrum is being dealt a serious blow. The emphasis on dealing with economic inequality, egalitarianism, the emphasis on populist policies, overall, that's actually what Mr. Bo represented, especially to the public, and of course, the flamboyance that he also carried with him. All of that actually suddenly is being pushed off the stage.
We want to understand better the kind of different perspectives that are at work here. You know, we took On Point to China a few years ago in 2008. We were there in advance of the Olympics, did the show out of Shanghai. And one of the things we picked up on while we were there was this new left versus right tension. And we talked with a couple of people about it at that time. And if I may, Dolly Young, Evan, I want to play some of that tape back for you. It was really interesting. This was On Point in China, in Shanghai. We spoke to Wang Wei in Beijing, intellectual leader of the so-called New Left. We also talked with Fang Xinghai. He's very high in the business circles in Shanghai, falls more on the right in Chinese politics. And here was Fang Xinghai with us in Shanghai, talking about a kind of government intervention impulse versus his preference, a more market-driven impulse within the Communist Party.
Should we use more government intervention, the more government possession of assets to promote the kind of growth that people want? Or should we have a more decentralized, more market-driven, more private entrepreneur, oriented growth? I'm for the latter type of growth.
There was the pro-market view from a very high-placed guest of ours in 2008. And here, from the New Left, Wang Wei from Tsinghua University in Beijing, speaking with us. This was in Shanghai. And his view from the New Left angle of the debate.
You need some kind of the market mechanism. But on the other hand, you need the state take the responsibility for these processes in order to guarantee the welfare of the workers and the ordinary peoples.
Dalian, can you explain for us what Bo Xilai was really standing for here? I mean, his son was driving reportedly a Ferrari through the streets in China, so it's not as though they're impoverished, but he seemed to be standing up for those who haven't not been necessarily the big winners in China's market push.
Absolutely. And he used a strong authority. He was very much actually a strong-willed leader who was willing to impose his will, and he was able to crack down on businesses, on crime, and also to build affordable housing. However, to give you a sense of the kind of leadership style that he had, he also decided, for example, to replant the trees in the city, millions of trees, actually, replace the original trees with more expensive trees gathered from across the country. So that's the kind of leader he was, charismatic, decisive, but also he wanted his own way.
Evan Osnos, what do the camps look like here then? If there are different camps within the power structure in China, I mean, how do they line up? Is Bo Xilai alone? Is there a considerable camp that's behind him, with him? Like who? Like in what kind of positions?
Well, he does have a constituency. I think exactly as Dali said, there are people who credit Bo Xilai with taking a greater interest in the everyman and looking out for regular people instead of looking out for some of the oligarchs who have generated huge fortunes here over the last 30 years. So the range of people that stand with Bo Xilai include, for instance, there are people at the higher ranks of the party who they owe their own political careers to his father, for instance, or to him himself, so they have a personal allegiance to him. There are people who see there are people in the party, for instance, who see that they would suffer if, in fact, there is a reduced role for the state. So if I'm a powerful somebody who stands to gain from the state maintaining its control. But then there's a range of other people who are ordinary people. For instance, I know some young Chinese nationalists who believe in Bo Xilai because they think that he's one of the people who stands up for the country against the encroachment of Western values, as they put it. So there are websites in China that espouse these kinds of neo-Maoist ideas. And in the last few days, as Bo Xilai's star has fallen, they have been shut down.
Dali Yang, it was just a few weeks ago that Mr. Bo was headed for the 9-member standing committee of the Communist Party's Politburo. I mean, this is as high in Chinese leadership as you can get. Now, how could he fall so far so quickly? If he was really genuinely headed for that high position of power, was this inevitable that he would be tripped up on his way there if his views are so unsettling to others? I mean, I'm looking here, Dali Yang, at Michael Anti, the Chinese blogger, writing that he talked to a Beijing cabbie who's denouncing what he called the shameless government for setting a trap for Bo Xilai and destroying a man who has helped the people. So was Bo Xilai really headed for the innermost circle of power, or was, you know, is there some countervailing power who just could not tolerate seeing him there, Dali Yang?
I think you're absolutely right. There were some countervailing powers that were not happy to see him rise. However, they could not attack him for seeing the red sounds, for example, or promoting policies that cater to the interest of the ordinary people. He was very popular publicly, and in fact, that's not the way that they could get at him.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, in the end, it's really this criminal case. The fact that his former police chief actually sort of went to the U.S. consulate, not only actually showed that there was a big split, that the police chief had violated laws, for example, in this case, but also handing information publicly, certainly to foreign forces and so on, that forced the leadership to reopen the investigation into the death of Neil Hayward And of course, following, in fact, the party document emphasized that they had done a reinvestigation of the case and found credible evidence that his wife may have been involved in the murder, and therefore, not only he could be blamed for the appointment, for the fact that his police chief had essentially decided to defect, but also the fact that his wife was misusing his influence in many ways. And of course, I'm pretty sure there will be additional charges and additional information that put him in very bad light as well. So it's the latter information, the criminal case involving a foreigner, that really did him in.
Evan Osnos, why? I mean, we don't know the truth of what happened here, but what's the sense of why Boshi Lai's wife, Gu Kai Lai, and I should say, this is a, by all accounts, a very, this is a beautiful, very intelligent woman, sort of, she has a look kind of like a Chinese Audrey Hepburn here. Why would she be involved, even hypothetically, in the murder of a British businessman in China? What?
Well, part of this gets to the very strange kind of wealth that has come to be associated with the highest ranks of the Communist Party these days, which is that when you get into power and you assemble that kind of authority here, you become very susceptible to corruption. And there is a lot we do not know about this case and about this family. And so we don't, you know, I don't want to rush to judge them.
Fair and true. Mm-hmm.
But what we know from what's been reported is that Gu Kai Lai, who was the daughter of a senior military figure in China, she was also kind of from this important political pedigree. Mm-hmm. She had become a lawyer, spoke good English. She, in fact, litigated a case in the United States, which was a precedent-setting event for a Chinese company. She wrote a book about that. She ended up having businesses abroad. The Wall Street Journal has reported that she had businesses registered in England. And then eventually she receded from public view and stopped playing an active role in her law firm. But in fact, it seems that she still maintained some important contacts with businessmen around the world, and she was doing business. We don't know exactly what. Mm-hmm. But Neil Haywood, in the days before his death, had told his friends that he had had a falling out with Boshi Lai's family, and he was in fact worried about his safety. The Wall Street Journal reports today that in fact he told friends that he was going to Chongqing and that he kept them abreast of where he was going and why, because he was concerned enough about his safety. So at a certain point, this relationship, this economic relationship between Bo's family and this British businessman who was essentially a fixer who would help people bring deals to China, that soured, and it soured so dramatically that he told his friends that he was worried about his safety.
But the implication here beyond this family, and you've referred to this, is that corruption at the very top level in China may be so widespread that if it's not just ideological, others at top levels may be concerned about being exposed if Boshi Lai begins to be exposed.
You know, this is the problem, essentially, for the party, is that because corruption has become so entrenched and so widespread, there's a kind of mutual non-aggression pact a lot of times. You don't go after another person's family. You don't go after another person's power base, because then they might go after yours. And so there is this constant stream of news in the Chinese papers about corruption investigations, about people being taken down. And some of it is spectacular. I mean, it's people being, for instance, caught with gold bars in the walls of their house in the case of a mayor. There was a senior official who was caught with 17 mistresses, if you believe what the Hong Kong press has reported about it. So it's this kind of completely over-the-top level of corruption. And it seems as if the party, I mean, a day does not go by in which the party does not say something about the absolute urgent crisis it faces to deal with corruption. And yet it continues.
Evan Osnos, hold the thought, if you would, in Beijing. And Dali Yang there. We're talking about this incredible story, power struggle going on in China right now, of Boshi Lai, his powerful wife, his police chief and a U.S. consulate, a dead British businessman. Listeners, what do you see? Is this the biggest Chinese leadership crisis in a generation? Is this a core inside tension bursting to the surface? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about uproar in the very top ranks of the Chinese Communist Party, the amazing case of the now disgraced party boss Bo Xilai now threatening to undo, perhaps, the ruling consensus in China, really mixing things up at the very top of the power structure in a country very much governed by the party. Evan Osnos is with us from Beijing. He's New Yorker, the New Yorker magazine's writer there. He's been writing really compellingly about this. Dali Yang is also with us from Beijing, faculty director at the University of Chicago Center in Beijing, author of Remaking the Chinese Leviathan. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you following this incredible story, power struggle in China? Is this a core inside tension bursting to the surface here, the old Maoist impulse rebelling at vast wealth, inequality, corruption? Do you see the biggest Chinese leadership crisis in a generation here? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's get a call from Lexington, Kentucky, and Brad. Brad, you're on the air.
How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, you know, I think this is the biggest thing that we've really heard of in China since Mao really came along. And, you know, I'm just wondering, is it two communist factions that are kind of struggling for power, or is there any democratic ideals in there at all?
Or it could be both. I mean, it could be either or. And Evan Osnos, what do you say?
The closest thing that comes to a democratic impulse these days is stop short of calling for real democracy. I mean, if you're in the party structure and you're trying to stay there, if you're trying to actually be in government, you can't openly call for democracy. But there are people, prominent people, like the current premier named Wen Jiabao and also some other up-and-coming officials who have said that it is absolutely time for political reform. They say we cannot continue in the form we are in now. If we continue down this path, it will ultimately undo all that we've been able to do over the last 30 years. And those calls have become increasingly urgent. This year, the Prime Minister, Wen Jiabao, said that the time for political reform, meaning that we need to open up the political process, we need to involve greater public participation, we have to be more responsive, more accountable, we have to have greater rule of law. There's a lot of good words there, and they say a lot of the right things, but what we have not seen is substantial movement in the direction of political reform in a very long time. And so there's this growing sense that that is overdue if the party wants to try to maintain the growth that it's built.
But Wen Xiaobao, the premier, went after Bo Xilai, who you say reminds you of Huey Long in American politics for that flamboyant kind of left-leaning way of wielding authority. But our listener Savishi writes that, you know, Wen Xiaobao openly critiqued him for the so-called Chongqing model in March, saying the wrong history track. Dali Yang, why did Wen Xiaobao, if he's more open to a kind of democratic impulse, why did he apparently attack Bo Xilai?
I think the biggest challenge that Bo posed was especially to the rule of law, because many of his policies, his practices ran roughshod over the law, particularly in cracking down on crime, on businesses, private businesses that have made money, and very often they were arbitrarily taken over with the assets seized and people thrown into jail with the slimmest evidence in a variety of cases. And there are people also who are thrown into jail for simply being critical of Bo. So in that sense, Wen Jiabao, whose family suffered grievously during the Cultural Revolution, pointedly emphasized, made the reference to the Red Sons, I guess, but also to the practices that Bo has implemented in Chongqing, saying that he could represent the return of the Cultural Revolution.
Wow. Andrew in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been listening to this, and I'm really taken back to my courses in Soviet history from college. Specifically, this conversation sounds very much like the Soviet Union of the 1930s, and that the Bo Xilai figure sounds very much like Sergei Kirov, who was assassinated and gotten out of the way of Stalin, and that the debates going on between the right and the left sound very much like the problems that went on between Trotsky and Bukharin. I'd love to hear your guest's comment on that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Andrew, I appreciate your call. Dolly Young, what do you say? Is there a parallel there? I don't know if Stalin had the equivalent of the big sort of a proto or capitalist impulse that's going on in China now, but what about that parallel?
I think the fear is, Mr. Bo, if he had risen to the top nine people to be one of them, he could actually have brought some of those practices onto the very top of the leadership. Nothing could have been able to prevent him from implementing some of those policies. And as a result, so that would have represented the sort of triumph of the left in China. So in many ways, in fact, there is element, and I think actually there is a strong presumption that there were people who are trying to get at Bo. But in the end, though, if it is his own family who apparently committed certain acts that got themselves into trouble. But again, though, one could also suspect that the reason that the family did certain things, for example, allegedly killing this British gentleman, was because they were afraid of certain secrets being leaked, especially after his son was reported as having had a very flamboyant life abroad, actually. That actually had really sullied the reputation of Bo, and then the family was very mad at that and basically decided to take some action, I think.
Evan Osnos, I mean, you can imagine Bo Xilai being described as corrupt or some kind of crazy lefty, maybe tough with the law, going after some private businesses here. On the other hand, I mean, when we were in China, you can't go to China without hearing a lot about inequality, enormous inequality and corruption of power. I mean, it's not as though there's not a need here for some countervailing power to the huge power of money in China now.
You know, I think that's exactly the reason why this story has been confusing to people who are looking at it from abroad. It is full of contradictions. I mean, think about it. You've got a guy who is now being described, Bo Xilai, as the voice of the left. I mean, he's the voice of sort of restoring the Communist Party to its full authority and so on. And yet at the very same moment, his son is being shown on the Internet, photographed at parties at Oxford. He's throwing events, bringing Jackie Chan to Oxford. He's driving around in a red Ferrari in Beijing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that combination, that kind of almost absurd contradiction, bothers people. I mean, on some deep level, the Chinese public has started to feel that there is this essential contradiction in what the party stands for, and there is no outlet for that to be resolved. That's the crisis, ultimately, that faces the party.
But can't you imagine? I mean, maybe it's the wrong version here. Some people say his wife was like Jackie Kennedy, and now she's like Lady Macbeth. But if he's in that JFK tradition, I mean, we saw in the U.S., very wealthy family, but put its shoulder to the wheel from the left. I mean, maybe in China today, if you don't have money, you can't even represent the people in this very money-conscious, money-dependent status world, Evan.
It has gotten to the point where people are exhausted a bit these days. I mean, there is this sense that the party, which ultimately, let's remember, was founded in the name of communism, socialism. I mean, this was the People's Republic
sure.
of China, and it has become essentially a kind of free market Wild West. And so the people who are left in the middle are the average folks. And you hear more than anything else these days in China, the complaint that you hear is that as an individual, somebody will say, I have no security. I have no sense of security. And what that means, the Chinese, in English, it means essentially, I have nobody will take care of me legally, economically, politically. There's nobody looking out for me. And that's a problem if you're the Communist Party, because your entire reason for being is to look out for that guy.
And that's not the sense in the street. Jim in Saratoga, New York. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because my son is leaving for China next week for a one-year job. And I was just concerned, could this spill out onto the streets and make China a less safe place?
There's a very real-world concern. Evan, I'll turn to you first on that. What about it?
The short answer is no. I mean, at the moment, this is contained within the elite halls of power. I mean, that's the remarkable thing about what we're seeing. And I think it's important to mention that if this was 30 years ago, you know, an ideological conflict of this kind could very well have already spilled out onto the streets. But it's not. I mean, it's being handled so far in a way that has that life in Beijing and life in China continues unobstructed. And I think when it comes to the decision about whether to send somebody over here, I would have no hesitation about it. Absolutely.
But the conversation you've written, Evan, is all over the place. I mean, social media, to the extent that the government has permitted it to talk about this, is just on fire with talk about this.
Well, and that's why I think the important thing to remember is that this right now really is the beginning of this process. It is probably not the end. And for anybody who's over here, whether it's a student or somebody in business or anybody, it's important to be mindful of what's happening in Chinese politics. And so, no, for the moment, there really is no reason to be concerned about coming here, about being here. And none of this that has happened is directed towards foreigners. And I just think it's important to remember that, you know, what we're talking about today is a political crisis, but it is not a crisis on the street.
Well, of course, except for one foreigner who's dead. And Jim, if your son were headed into membership in the Politburo, you might have some concerns, but I doubt that's the job he's going for. Mike in Nashville, Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mike.
Listen, what's the State Department going to do with the explosive sheaf of documents that were brought in by the police chief to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu? Do you suppose State is going to release them, let them dribble out slowly, or sit on them forever? The potential for an explosion, though, of course, is very high.
It's a great question, Mike. I mean, maybe WikiLeaks will put them out. But what about Dali Yang, the police chief, Wang Lijun, reportedly went in with lots of documents about the innermost power struggles. He's now looking at treason charges. But what about the information that was given to the U.S.? What do we know, Dali Yang?
We know that whatever he came in into the consulate, he came out carrying them. So as a result, in fact, the Chinese authorities actually have that information. In fact, he would have every incentive to cooperate with the investigators to make sure that he bring down Mr. Bo. And in fact, the only reason he really tried to do this was to protect himself and also truly to fight Mr. Bo, who apparently had a fallout with him. So in that sense, actually, the Chinese already have in possession the same information and probably much more now because they are also doing other investigations in connection with this particular case. At the same time, the party is rallying around the country, especially in the major cities, to make sure that the decisions that they have announced spread across campuses into major organizations, really to rally the country around the party leadership.
Evan, he may have come out with those documents, but we all know what photocopiers are. What do you you think the U.S. government learned anything in that with that sheaf of documents they didn't know already?
Yes, I think there's no question. I think Dali is absolutely right that he came out with those documents, and that's a smart thing for him to do. He also, according to Western officials, he did need to show them what he had, talk to them about what he had in order to substantiate his argument for political asylum. He was trying to move to the United States, and in order to do that, he was trying to make a case that he had valuable insights and that he also was personally in danger. In the end, the United States didn't grant asylum, and part of that is, as a technical matter, I'm told that the consulate says that they would have literally had no ability to take a Chinese citizen, particularly a senior party official of this kind, take him into a U.S. consulate and then somehow get him to the United States. That just is not the way the system works. And on top of that, it would have been hugely damaging to U.S.-China relations at a very sensitive moment. This was just a few days before the Chinese incoming president, Xi Jinping, was scheduled to arrive in Washington for a major summit. And look, the United States, frankly, had no incentive to go public with the knowledge that it gained. It has a lot more value being
sure
kept in whatever schedule they needed.
But he was in there for 30 hours, and you can bet that a lot got said. David in Boston, thanks for calling, David. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment that I really feel like I lived in China in the mid-90s before the last transition to Wen Jiabao.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this whole transition to Bo Xilai is away from him is the party really preparing for that power transition and trying to unify that power message. The speakers were talking earlier about it's very hard for people to reconcile some of the contradictions in what they're hearing from the party and what they're seeing from the party at the moment. And I think that this is really a moment where the party was sort of saying, you know, shape up or ship out, and there were certain elements within it that weren't able to shape up in the way they wanted, and so those elements have now been shipped out in preparation for creating that very unified party front that, that the Chinese Communist Party is so so impressively capable of maintaining when the situation calls for it.
And always determined to do that. Dolly Yang, do you think they'll come up with that? Will the transition ultimately be orderly here that's coming up right in front of us this year at the top in the Chinese Communist Party? And what do you think the long-term impact of this whole uproar will be?
I think the emphasis of the leadership would be on stable transition, and they are actually going to be working very hard to ensure that's the case. There may be additional repercussions from the Bo case, but overall, though, the leadership is actually has forged a reasonable consensus. It's also rallied the party around it. So as a result, coming in the fall, they are going to hold their new party congress. In the process, however, they are going to be giving greater emphasis to discipline, to anti-corruption, to all sorts of issues. So this actually allows those people who are against the kind of leadership that Mr. Bo represents to do more screening to ensure that the next generation, especially the younger ones who are coming into the top of the power, would be following the rules and so on. Of course, the very top leaders like Mr. Xi Jinping and Mr. Li Keqiang, they have already been selected, and they are going to be succeeding in a way that would be more orderly than had been the case. Let me emphasize in this context, China had only had one orderly transition of power under the communist leadership. That was actually the last one, to Wen Jiabao and Hu Jintao. And today, this is only the second time, and obviously we are seeing a major hiccup. But it's not a massive crisis that had happened in 1989, nor was it like in 1976 when Mao died. The party actually has quickly regrouped, and they are going to make use of this case, and perhaps there may be some good coming out of it, especially in the direction of the rule of law, respect for the law, and so on.
Dolly Yang with the University of Chicago Center in Beijing. Dolly Yang, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Evan Osnos, so does the juggernaut just roll over this uproar or lasting effect? We just got 10 seconds, Evan.
Well, I think we'll have to wait and see. I think there's more to come, but let's hope that this, in fact, clears things out of the system and that they can move in the direction of greater rule of law.
Whatever that means for China. Evan Osnos with The New Yorker. Thank you so much, Evan. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.